Today we're here with Derek from Sea, who founded Sea Baby, and Derek's got quite a story, and we were actually just talking a little bit before the interview started, and he's a little bit of a traveler like I am. Derek, take it away, tell us about yourself.
Stepping into it like that, huh? All right, my name's Derek Rivers. I'm a musician, really. I decided when I was 14 years old I was going to do nothing but music for life, and kind of stuck with it. Last time I had a job was 1992. I've been making a full-time living in music since then. And around 1997, I was selling my own CD at live shows and sold about 1,500 copies of my CD at shows before I decided I wanted to try to get it up and sell it online because I was doing this radio campaign at the time. And it was my CD was number one at college radio stations spread out around the U.S. So it's like in New Mexico, Maine, and Alaska. My CD was number one. And I wanted to get it up and selling online so people from those places could buy it. And, man, in 1997, it was very different world online. You know, there was no PayPal, so there was no way to accept payments online. Amazon only sold books, and there was literally, as a musician, not a single place online you could sell your CD, except maybe eBay. But, you know, it's not really where people shop for music. So I went calling around the big online record stores and asked if I could sell my CD to them. And they said, well, we're just the front end to the major label distribution system, so the only way you can be for sale on CD now, for example, is if you're signed to a major through a major distribution. And I said, well, that sucks. Can't I just send you a box of CDs and you sell it and pay me? And they just laughed and said, look, it didn't work that way, you know. So really just set up CD Baby to scratch my own itch, just to sell my own CD, because there was just nowhere else to do it. So I never even really meant to start a business. To be clear, I didn't start CD Baby necessarily. It was just on my band's website. I went through the 3 months of hell to get my own credit card merchant account. You know, fill out all the forms, set up $1,000 in setup fees. They actually had to send an inspector out to my location to make sure I was a valid business. I had it set up.
And your location was what, a bedroom in your house, right?
Exactly. They really did send that inspector, and luckily I had it set up for the recording studio, so I had to lie and say that I was taking credit card payments for my recording studio because they didn't allow people to take credit card payments online at the time. So, yeah, I had to go through 3 months of red tape and set up, and then I had to learn how to create a shopping cart online, which also was pretty difficult in 97. I had to copy examples out of books, you know, CGI bin, Perl scripts, and all that stuff. And, man, after 3 months of hard work, I had a buy now button on my website. And that's when some of my fellow musicians in New York said, hey, could you sell my CD through that? And I said, well, sure, I guess. So what later became CD Baby really was just me doing a favor for some friends around New York.
And how big did CD Baby get to?
Let's see, so I started it at the end of 97, and it just had maybe 10 or 20 musicians on it at first. But because I was the only one doing anything like that, word of mouth was spreading around musicians, like, if you want to sell your CD online, there's this guy, Derek, who can hook it up. He was really going to talk about business, you know, what do you call it, startup environments. There was just no competition. I was the only guy that would get your CD up and selling online. So I think within a few years, CD Baby was the largest seller of independent music online. And then by the time I sold it 10 years later in 2008, we did about 100 million in sales for 150,000 musicians.
So what was like that per year?
About 20 million U.S.,
And so you sold for 22 million, so you got out one times revenue.
I was doing about net profit of about 4 million a year, so it was about a 6 or 7 times net or so.
Nice.
Yeah.
And you just walked away, and I mean, have you been doing more business stuff since then, or has that been your main thing?
That was my main thing. I'm setting up something new right now, but I sold it for personal reasons. It's funny that a lot of people assume that the reason you're doing something is for the money, and the reason you want to exit is for the money, but for me it was neither, you know, and it's kind of pulled the longer version of why I started, because it was really just me doing a favor for friends. I didn't think that there was any money in this. And same thing's getting out. The healthy profit, $4 million a year, I didn't really need the money. You know what I mean? I had no investors, so that was 100% mine. And just really for personal reasons, I hit this point where in the end of 2007, I did a complete rewrite of the software. Ground up, fixed all of the mistakes and bugs and all of my regrets, and made this amazing version of what I felt was really everything that I ever wanted the website to be. And at the end of 2007, I finished, and I launched it, and it went well. And I really had this sense of completion. Like, I'm done. I don't know what else to do with this thing. So it got to the point where I felt my clients were actually more ambitious than I was. They were wanting to grow the career and grow. And I didn't even want to grow anymore. I just felt like, I'm done. That's it for me. So it was Seth Godin, actually, who I'm sure your listeners probably know. Seth Godin, the author of a bunch of books like The Purple Cow. And
right, yeah, my people heard him.
Yeah, so he's been kind of a mentor to me over the years, and when I told him about the situation, he's the one that actually encouraged me to sell. He said, you know, if you care about your clients and your company, you should sell, because the idea was that I was doing my company a disservice by remaining at helm when I was feeling completely unambitious about it. So,
but you had, I read somewhere you had it, like, totally automated by that point. You could have just sat back and let it keep going, couldn't you?
Exactly. That's what I was doing for the rest of 2007 and 2008. I hadn't even been to the office in a few years, it was growing, but that's just because I really had no desire to grow it. I didn't want to do anything about it. I didn't want to improve it so much. I just kind of felt like sitting back and doing nothing. And
could it have been running fairly comfortably, generating $4 million profit a year the way it was?
Yeah, it would have. Yeah.
So I mean, to sell for $22 million, if it can make $4 to $5 million a year in profit, could you have got a lot better for it?
I could have. That's just it. When I decided to sell, it was prompted because I got 3 offers in 1 week. So the whole time I was running a company, I would always, every month or so, get some VC firm somewhere offering to buy or some competitor offering to buy, and I always just shoot them away and said no, didn't even entertain a notion. But in January 2008, in one single week, I got 3 calls, told them all no, and it was later that weekend that I started thinking about it. Like, well, you know what, I've just been saying no for 10 years, but maybe. And so I called them all back and said yes and let them bid against each other. So Amazon was in the running and was actually willing to offer much more money, but I felt that Discmakers, the company that I chose, I'd known them for 7 years, and they had already been dealing with independent musicians for many more years than that. So I felt that they would do a better job of taking care of my clients. Like, they would know my clientele and understand them better than Amazon. So, I chose Discmakers for less money, because I just felt that they would, my clients would be in better hands.
Now, can I ask, was it a lot less? Don't tell me if you don't want to answer that.
It's hard to say, because with Amazon, we were still negotiating. There was no kind of final offer, but that was many millions less. But, you know, for a certain point, what does it really matter? What's the difference between $22 million and $32 million? You know, it's a... we do it anyway. I decided to give it all away anyway, so it didn't really matter.
You decided to give it all anyway?
Yeah, so the thing is, after we had a handshake deal and agreed upon price, and there were a few months of paperwork to go before the deal was done, I was talking with my lawyer and accountant, and kept feeling a little overwhelmed. Like, okay, what the hell do you do with $22 million that was the final sales price? And I told him, you know, I don't even really want the money. I really wanted all to go to charity anyway. I just want to know that I don't have to get a job at some point later in life. I want to know that I'm taken care of, but I don't really think it would be harmful for me to have $20 million. So they told me about this thing. I don't know if other countries have this, but the U.S. has something called the Charitable Remainder Unit Trust, which is a charitable trust you can set up that pays out to the settler, it pays out 5% of its value per year for life, and then when you die, it all goes to charity. So it's usually set up by people at retirement age who want to give everything away, but want to make sure that they still have a little trickle coming in to help pay for their basic cost of living. So I just set that up. That gets earlier than most people do. So what I did, it was kind of a cool move, is months before I sold the company, I actually transferred the ownership of the whole company as much as possible into this charitable trust. I set up the charitable trust, transferred the company's ownership into the trust, so that when Discmakers bought the company, they didn't actually buy it from me, they bought it from the trust, which meant that all of that money got to go into the trust tax-free, which makes no difference to me, because it means that millions more will go to charity in the end. And then I just get paid out this 5% trickle for the rest of my life, which is enough for me.
So you get $1 million a year, go and travel and do have fun all over the world in this trust, and then the money just then goes to charity when you're done? I mean, what a great deal.
Yep. And it means that it gets to grow tax-free, too. So the whole time, you know, it's invested in whatever, just, you know, passive stock investments, and because it's already a charitable vehicle, it gets to just grow tax-free for the rest of my life, too, which is, you know, in the end, it just felt like that's more gets to go to... It's already set up for music education, so it's all going to go to music education when I die, so...
And what particular types of music education?
I don't know yet. It's just left for... Who knows whether that'll be, later tonight if I get hit by a bus, or if it'll be 100 years from now when I'm 104 years old. So I had to just leave it ambiguous for the trustee to handle at the time. So
the executives of your estate then will figure out what would be an appropriate type of music education that you would have approved of, and then it will go the money worth that.
Yeah, I named a few charities already, but who knows if they'll be around when I die or not.
I've never heard a story like this.
Thanks. Well, it's funny, you never have to do things the normal way. I think maybe just because I've been a rebellious musician my whole life, I didn't start my company the normal way, I didn't run it in a normal way, and so when I was doing this, I think we're all free to kind of shape the world in our image, and I just, I have this thing where I don't want $20 million. You couldn't pay me to own Ferrari. I don't want a 19-bedroom mansion. I think that would be horrible. I just want a decent life. So I like the idea of getting as much of it out of my hand as possible, and just as long as I was taken care of for life. And I don't know, I was really thrilled when I found this vehicle.
Did you undo it if you changed your mind, or is it the way it is?
No, I can't. It's gone. It's the day, months before the company was sold. When I signed the company into the charity, it was on. It was no longer mine. And the money's not mine, and I can't get it back till I want to. Same thing with the new company I'm setting up. I'm actually doing the same thing for the new company. I set up a trust first, and the trust is actually starting a new company and signing me as director of it, so that even my new company that I'll be spending the next 10 years working on, I'm not the owner of that one either. A charitable trust owns that as well.
Hmm.
So, I like this idea.
Do you feel like, would you have gone and done like crazy stuff with the money, or did you,
Maybe that. Actually, it was a little bit protecting myself from my future self. I know some friends of mine that have sold their companies in the past, and a friend of mine sold his company for like $35 million about 5 years ago. And I catch him doing stupid things, like talking about money, hearing phrases like "only $10 million." You know, we're thinking of buying this building at only $10 million. That's, you know, for personal use, not business use. I never wanted to be one of those people that I don't know, it can be damaging to the psyche if you look at your bank account and you see there's $20 million in there at your full expression to use for anything you want. I think that could just be powerful and make you, start to devalue it in your head, or, you know, start to do stupid things like flying, you know, chartering private jets instead of just taking a regular business class seat. You know what I mean? You start throwing it away because you can. So I left the idea of intentionally limiting myself so that I didn't even have that kind of stupid money to throw away.
What about, have you ever thought, like, say some serious accident or something happened to a family friend or someone in your family that you could have saved that money, now you can't?
Well, that's where I had to say, okay, is this 5% per year enough? And I think that's, let's admit it, that $1 million a year for life is enough for almost anything that could possibly come up, short of some rare disease that nobody's ever heard of, and the only thing that's going to solve is $10 million and $1 million won't do it. I mean, if it really comes down to that, I could probably take out a loan,
right.
You know what I mean? It's just there's a beautiful quote from Joseph Heller, the author who wrote the book Catch-22, was hanging out with Kurt Vonnegut. Two of them were friends, and they were at some giant multimillionaire's party in the Hamptons in Long Island. And Kurt Vonnegut went up to Joseph Heller and said, the guy has everything, doesn't he? And Joseph Heller said, I've got one thing that he'll never have, enough. I like that idea of enough.
Fair enough. I've not had an interview like this before. You are the first.
Hey, you warned me before we started that you'd like to speak bluntly, so
yeah.
You can talk about anything.
No, I'm fascinated. I really am. What I guess I'm having trouble reconciling is that, I mean, you're a guy that you did go out and build a $20 million business. You did go and then sell it and make a lot of money. You are going out to start another business. It's not like you're working in a Starbucks or something like that. I mean, your persona, the impression you give is that you're a laid-back guy, but if you've done that kind of stuff, you can't be that laid-back.
Oh, no, I'm definitely not laid-back. It's just that I realized that money interests me. I use money as a barometer of measuring the value of what I'm doing. Like, if I'm doing something valuable, that means that enough people find it valuable that they're opening their wallets to pay for it, and that's how I can tell it's valuable. Short of, say, something like education, or you can do charitable things where their value is not measured in money. But for the most part, with anything entrepreneurial, I think you can kind of measure its value in money. Like, if the public is finding it valuable, they'll open their wallets to pay for it. So it's really use money as a measure, and money inspires me, but then I realized I didn't necessarily want it for myself. I just wanted to earn it, not have it. So for some weird reason, the idea of earning it but then giving it to others excites me more than earning it and keeping it for myself, which makes me feel kind of icky. I'm definitely not laid back. I've always been a workaholic, but it's just separating the idea of needing to keep the money from being ambitious. You can be ambitious without wanting money. That's all.
Very, very interesting. And how was the general reaction of people when you told them about this?
Well, my lawyer is the funny one. When I told him that he was the one that suggested this, the way that I sold my company, transferring it into charitable trust first. But just over and over again, he said, "You understand that it'll be gone. You can't change mine. It's irreversible. The company is no longer yours. You don't own it anymore. The trust is selling it. You get that, right? This is irreversible. When you sign this piece of paper, on and on." I said, "Yeah, I totally get it." And then when I came back to him months later and said, "I'm going to be starting this new company, and I'd like to do that again from scratch, because I'd like to set up a trust first and have the trust own the company from day one." And again, he said, "Okay, you realize this means you're going to be working for the next 10 or whatever years, day and night, to build your new company, and you're not going to earn a dime. You understand that, right?" And I went, "Yep."
In the new company, let's say you turn it into a $100 million company and then sell it, does that mean the proceeds then go into the new trust for music education?
Yeah, exactly. And even though just all along, even all the net profits of the company aren't mine, and I'll just get a dollar a year or whatever for being the director. But even the profits along the way won't go to me. And the reason of my life is living on that 5% that I described earlier, so even the profits of the new company won't go to me.
I've talked to one friend who's already made his money for living for the rest of his life, and one comment that he had was that he felt like in some ways he lost his edge a little bit because he already had everything he needed.
Yeah, definitely. I find that sometimes, that feeling of just the past year since I sold CD Baby. A few times, something in my new company has come down to some real work, and I find myself going, I don't have to. It's a weird feeling knowing you could just sit there and basically, do the cliche of just drinking margaritas for the rest of your life. But I had this great, here's a turning point to me. It's somewhere there, let's see, this was a few months before the sale of the company was done, but it was already basically done, just, papers weren't signed yet. And I took a vacation, and I went off to the southern tip of Japan took a train to a bus to a ferry to a volcano off the southern tip of Kyushu, like just got as remote as I could get, and checked myself into some hot springs spa and just sat there melting in this spa, looking out at the world, and, you know, just sat there for a few days of this absolute, you know, melting, empty-minded bliss. But after only the second or third day,
you're thinking, like, what the hell am I doing here, right?
Yeah, well, back in my room, I had this fascinating book written by Charlie Munger, who is Warren Buffett's partner.
Right.
But this amazing book that was just sparking all kinds of ideas in me, and just and I wanted to try out these ideas. It was kind of like fascinating approaches to business, and with a certain way of measuring things. And I wanted to try out. I got a little sad that I had no company in which to try out these ideas. And that's when I realized, you know what? Like, the reason to have a company, we always think we're doing it for the money or we're doing it for the glory or whatever. But if your company is kind of like a laboratory. It's kind of like a classic, you know, the guy had a garage where he goes to tinker with his go-kart, you know, or a basement where you've got your model trains laid out. It's kind of like your laboratory where you go to experiment and play and tinker and test things. When you own your own company, it's kind of like that. Every time you hear some business concept or idea that excites you, you can go try it in your company.
Right.
And so there I was melting in some spa in Japan going, I want a company again, just because. I don't even care about the money. I just want to taste it, tinker, and try my ideas and see if they work. And
I read the memoirs of Jim D. Rockefeller, who I guess spent a lot of time living just up north of where you are now in New York. And one of the things that he talked about was one of the things that excited him the most about business was being around young men and working on interesting business ideas.
That's cool. I didn't know that. And there was a quote from George Soros. Let's see if I can find it. I wrote it down once. Cool. Here we go. I found it. George Soros was being interviewed, and the interviewer said, have your billions made you happy? And he said, I'm reasonably happy, but the money's not the point. It's an indication that I've succeeded in the grand adventure of understanding reality.
Oh, that's good.
I like that. It's like all these theories that you hear about. You read a business book. It's all just theories about the world and how people work and how motivation works and what makes people buy and what makes people, you know, do certain things. It's all just testing the way the world works and owning your own company. It's a great way to test these theories about the world, and that's kind of what I meant about 10 minutes ago when I said I'm still really interested in money as a measure that my experience is successful, that I'm doing something that's of value to the world. Even if I don't want to, actually I don't want to keep it, but it's still an interesting measure that you're doing something valuable.
Very, very interesting. So your first company you didn't have any funding for, now you've given your money away. Like, are you going to have any funding for your next company, or is it going to be built from ground up as well?
But from the ground up, what I did to set up the new trust is I'm just transferring a small amount of money into to fund the trust, and that small amount will be all that's in there to set up a new company. But setting up like a holding company, so it's my first little experiment as well. There will be funds in there to fund the next one, you know, et cetera. So I'm going to always aim to do it without any investors, unless I do something, you know, stupid like start an airline or whatever. I don't really see the – I'm happy working on a really small scale. I never really wanted to do that thing of starting a brand company and raising many millions of dollars to start something huge. I like the idea of tinkering with small things that don't need something.
I'm interested to ask more on your thoughts on that. Can you talk about, like, how much fund you're actually putting in and what you're setting aside and, you know, how you grow it? I'm really interested to understand that, if you're willing to talk about it.
Sure. Well, I mean, I'm just doing this really naively. You know, we can always try to predict how the future will go, but I might be massively wrong. I mean, we'll find out. So CD Baby, I started with $500. And that was just, it's funny, when I think about what, the only money I ever put into CD Baby was that $500, and that went to $99 for a copy of Dreamweaver to build the site, right, the HTML builder, $20 for my first month of web hosting, and then $375 for that fucking SSL certificate. You know, it was the biggest startup expense, $375 for that SSL certificate.
My friend Mark Shuttleworth would like to thank you for your contribution to that market, and Aerosign bought him for $575 million.
Exactly.
And he does fly around private planes, and I'm sure he really appreciates your contribution.
We're actually, I just switched from Mac back to Linux because Ubuntu has become so amazing. So I'm a huge fan of Mark's. He's a hero of mine. So that was my entire money that I put into CD Baby. I just grew it from that $500. And, you know, I think the first month I lost money, I only made $300 the first month. But the second month in business, I made $700, and that's profitable. And I think, you know, my 11th month in business, I probably only made $1,000. But it grew really slowly like that, but I was net profitable. So, I'm cool with that kind of slow growth. So my new company, Muckwork, is a remote assistant firm. So say for anybody who read 4-Hour Workweek, you know the idea of the virtual assistant firms in India that have people that are well-versed in helping you, as if you were hiring an assistant, but just hiring them by the hour or literally by the minute for whatever you need help with.
Mm-hmm.
An assistant sits at a computer somewhere in the world, and you outsource the things you need help with to them instead of needing to hire a person that sits next to you in your office that works 9-to-5, 40 hours a week. So I'm setting up a virtual assistant firm for musicians, with people working from home worldwide, or already well-trained to help musicians with the things they need help with. So if a musician needs some help, whether it's booking some gigs or copywriting their songs or updating their MySpace page, they just ask somebody from Upwork to help them out with it. So the startup costs are really nothing. Just incorporating it. I'm doing programming myself. So at least my idea now is that just I'm putting $5,000 into trust to fund, say, the first month of business. And hopefully hopefully the first month will be profitable, and I can just grow it slowly after that.
So what happens if not?
Put another few thousand dollars in. And then at a certain point, it's still not profitable, then I guess you could say that experiment didn't go well. I mean,
so like what you could potentially be doing here is a cap of up to 10 grand you'll put into this, and then if that hasn't worked out, then you'll shut it down and move on to the next thing.
Perhaps, although it's just a matter of time, isn't it? I mean, it's just because something hadn't worked yet doesn't mean it never will. So I could, I could keep trying. We'll just see what happens over the next year. But I'm quite committed to it. Business aside, I mean, we have certain interests in life. So I guess at a certain point, it seems Mark Shuttleworth got fascinated with creating a new Linux distribution. And I don't think he was doing it for the money. It's just something that he was probably an interest of his that he was fascinated with. I'm guessing. I don't know if you have other insights to add. But,
he doesn't publicly say it. Actually, I won't find it.
Okay. But so for the last 11 years, I was really just geeked out on, completely obsessed with how to sell music. And that was my fascination. So CD Baby just grew out of the fact that I was fascinated with first how to sell my own music than how to sell other people's music. And I spent 11 years with almost every waking thought spent on how do I sell music. And I'm not really interested in that anymore. So what's really fascinating me now is the combination of, like, how do I get things done through others, not trying to do everything myself, and how do I work with other people to get things done? How do I work with people, especially remotely, with, so that, what do you call it, crowdsourcing or just the getting things done?
So what you're doing is niching the concept. I mean, I actually saw a New York startup that is doing exactly what you're talking about, and I guess I'm sure there's others out there providing, an interface onto the hordes of offshore people that want to do work. But what you're doing, which I've never heard before, is niching that, and so therefore you'll have teams that become very closely trained and understand the needs a lot better and hopefully be able to do a high-quality job.
Exactly.
You have distribution and to clients because you must have deep relationships within the music industry.
Exactly. When I sold the company, when I sold CD80, I got to keep my clients and customer base. That was condition number one of a sale, is that I get to keep my clients.
How do you mean you got to keep them? You got the email list or what?
Yeah, well, it was just basically the day I sold the company, the minute the wire transfer went through, I did one last dump of the database, the entire database, and I got to keep that and continue to talk with whatever clients and customers were signed up to CD80 as of that moment. I'm free to continue talking with. So now I guess you could say it's a shared database up until that point, and only the
people. All right, Mr. Dave of the world. Now, come on. I mean, that's a pretty smart business move you've done there, and I haven't heard anyone else tell me they've done that move. So,
The deal was, again, when I was thinking of selling, I called back the companies that were interested, and I said, all right, look, here's my condition. I want to keep my clients because I'm planning on starting another company that's going to be helping musicians. So I also need a very narrow non-compete because I need you to understand that I'm not going to but I need to understand that I'm going to be doing this company that's also going to be helping the same musicians, even helping them with very similar things. So we're probably going to end up working side by side. So I won't compete directly I won't be starting another online music store. I won't be starting another web hosting company, but I'll be helping the same musicians with promotion and outsourcing and whatnot. So it's just condition of the sale.
So they all know you, and you send an email out to your list, and they all respond and all that sort of stuff?
Exactly. So, in fact, the cool thing is that the sale of the company, I kind of symbolically came out from behind the veil, or whatever, the curtain of CD Baby.
Oh, did they know who you were before?
A lot of them did. I mean, they've been receiving emails for years that had my name signed on it, but it was only about CD Baby business. So if you look at my blog now, cyprus.org, it's still stuff that's useful for musicians, but now it's really just kind of me just communicating not as direct CD Baby guy, but just direct some guy that is out there trying to help musicians with various things. So I'm actually more in touch with my clients than ever, just in a more ambiguous way for now.
So, I mean, there's almost no chance then when you get started that it won't work.
Yeah, except that I'm so.
I mean, you have the two hardest things. One you have is the distribution, and then the second thing you have is the relationship and the level of trust with the people in that distribution. So as long as you don't totally screw it up right from the start, it's going to be pretty hard for you not to make it work.
Exactly. So unless it's really something that the market just doesn't want, but I think they do need it. I have 150,000 musician clients that I think need it, and probably 10 or 20,000 of them will agree. And so I've got my client base built in for my next business. Maybe that's why I'm kind of pretty confident that it will work. And even if it doesn't at first, I'm so fascinated with this idea of outsourcing and getting things done through others that I think I'm just going to stick with it for years. So even if the first incarnation doesn't work, I'm just going to keep at it.
And even through times when, there's real work you got to do.
Yeah, well, that's the hard part. But it's funny, this idea of saying, well, how much of it do I need to do myself? I enjoy doing programming myself, but maybe, for example, I won't be present. Maybe I'll just be the guy that kind of funds it, helps bring the client base, and from day one, send somebody else to be president of it. or let's say from day two, I guess, since I won't be able to pay them from day one, I'll just kind of get that first little 1% going, then hand off to somebody else to run it. Where I can.
I mean, there are thousands of ambitious guys in New York City that you could probably bring on to do something like that.
Exactly.
Probably, you know, the other way you can even do that is offer that out to 150,000 musicians. There's probably a guy up in there that we search for.
Yeah, definitely. So.
I'm back, mate. I've never heard anyone talk like you before. There's a lot of people.
Thanks.
This is something you want to do by just like traveling around the world too, right? Do you intend to build an office and a team and stuff like that, or is this going to be you like globetrotting?
In fact, part of the reason that I left CD Baby is I hated having the responsibility of, I had 85 employees, and they were the main reason I left. Is you know, I see that you you've interviewed Tony from Davos. Mm-hmm. He talks about how at his previous company before Davos, he hated the fact that he let the internal culture get corrupt to the point where he hated going to the office himself.
And he designed Zappos to be the company they wanted to be with forever.
Exactly. So CD Baby, for the first 8 of its 10 years, it's had that awesome culture. Where it's, you know, like if I don't know, about the last 2 years, for whatever weird balance of reasons I'm analyzing to that myself, the internal culture got corrupt to the point where I hated it. And then it became like the metaphorical rotten apple that spoils the barrel, like a few rotten eggs or rotten apples spoil the whole barrel. And pretty soon, I felt like the only way I could possibly continue with the company was either to fire everybody and hire a new crew, or fire everybody and say, like, move the company all the way to Texas or something, as a way of just getting out of town and avoiding all that bad blood, and you know, people will hate me at the old one because it got so corrupt, or just selling it and walking away and making it not my problem anymore. So
do you think that was a real reason that you sold?
That was a huge part of it, yes. I think if I really had some lovey-dovey kind of relationship with my employees that I had 2 years before, I probably would have stuck it out longer. Like, we would have felt that we were in this together, and maybe I would have assigned some more control over to them and stepped back a little bit myself, that the company could have continued under my ownership. But it was really because things had gotten so bad with the employees that they hated me, I hated them, and we really weren't on speaking terms. I really didn't speak to my employees for the last year and a half of the company. It was that bad. So I kind of vowed to work. My new company is, I'm going to do an experiment. I'm going to see if I can do a company with no employees and have everybody, even the management, be freelance people offering their time that aren't bound to me, but whoever wants to do the task. It's kind of this experimenting crowdsourcing that may go horribly wrong, but I guess we can, you know, talk about that in a couple of years and see how it went if you're interested.
Yeah, I mean, very much so. Well, I'm shocked. Your style comes across as a soft style, and I mean, yeah.
It's a classic California parent example. It's too soft. I mean, you know, I can't think of what movies, you know, say like Willy Wonka with Veruca Salt. You know, the kid that gets everything becomes the worst brat of all. So I went so above and beyond to try to keep all the employees so happy. Mm. I actually over-empowered them to the point where the same month that we won the award in, I think it was like Oregon Magazine or Portland Magazine or something like that, named CD Baby the number one best place to work in Portland. And did a 50-year-length article about us, how it's the greatest place to work in Portland. And people who voted us into that place were the employees themselves. And that same month, they, you know, got so empowered that they signed a big, giant manifesto about everything else that they wanted to change about the company, and basically wanted me to get out of the way and run the company the way that they wanted it, and stop telling them what to do and get out of the way. And it kind of got, yeah, a little bit kind of too, I think there was a psychology term for it, like the riding tide of expectations or something like that. Like when.
So you want me to? I want to come over there and give you a big hug. I'm feeling like.
Well, the funny thing is, I know that a lot of this was my fault. My friends, of course, you know, your friends that care about you, they'll be on your side. They'll say, "Man, I can't believe what those bastards are doing to you. They're so ungrateful." But at the same hand, I know that I'm the guy that created that internal culture.
Right.
And I have
to be fixed. There's people you can hire that can help you with all those sorts of things. And I mean, that's not an area that I know at really all. So I couldn't tell you how it could be done. But there are certainly people that who understand those things. You never thought to bring in like an organizational development consultant or someone like that to help you with it.
I did, but I think that's where the timing thing happened. Where if it would have gotten corrupt a few years earlier, where I was still deeply passionate about selling music and deeply passionate about CD Baby, then of course I would have just found a way to fix it. But I think that because things got really bad around year 9 of 10, I think it happened about the time that I was getting a little sick of doing it anyway. And it's like, you know what, I think.
So what was the employee reaction when you did sell?
I don't know, because I wasn't speaking with them. I really, there was a point at the end of, I don't want to go into this kind of like, you know, crying into my beer story, but there was a point where it was mid-2007, and the tide internally had turned so against me that we had this every week kind of company meeting. Every week we'd get together and talk about things. So I was out of town that week, and we had always recorded recorded the meetings on my phone for the sake of those who couldn't make it. It was saved as an MP3 on hard drive later, so whoever wasn't there could listen to it. So this time I was the one who wasn't there, and the day later, lugged into the company hard drive and listened to the meeting. It was the vice president of the company, the guy that used to, he actually used to be my roommate. When he first moved to town, I put him up at my place for a few months. He was the guy that I felt was my best friend inside the company. He was the one leading the meeting, where he kind of led the company meeting and said, all right, guys, you know, basically this job sucks and this place sucks, and Derek's off trotting the world with his ivory back scratcher, and we're here, you know, he's living off the sweat of our brows, and something, and, you know, he seemed like a whole kind of, like, he kind of rattled at the crowd who was going, you know, fuck him. And you know, here's my, I was sitting here listening to this MP3 of my entire company, basically, you know, calling every name and yelling, fuck him. And when somebody would say, fuck him, the rest of everybody would applaud and cheer, and I was just listening to this going, wow, like, I'm done. You know, and so I really just kind of, I sent an email to the company. I was like, guys, I'm through with you. Like, I've done everything I could to try to make you happy, and I don't know what else to do at this point. I'm not speaking to you anymore. I will continue to do the programming. You guys are on your own. You won't hear from me ever again. We're done. And I sent an email out to the company kind of mid-2007. That was the last time I spoke to them. So when I told the company at the end of 2008, I already had spoken to them in a long time, so it was just...
But they all stayed in their jobs and can't do anything. Like, who was running the company?
Well, they said it's kind of... if you've read that book, The E-Myth Revisited, CDAB really was set up at a system that just worked. So I was keeping in touch with some things remotely. So there were a couple people at the company that had the authority to hire and fire, and it had been that way for years. But there wasn't like a person that ran things. It was just a system that worked. You know what I mean? So that's why it's...
Let's say someone in a key position quits or something like that. It was self-healing enough that if someone in a key person quits, that they would find a new one and replace them.
Yeah, and I think that did happen once. So during that year, even when I said, like, I'm done with you guys, I'm not speaking to you, yeah, I think somewhere in there somebody quit, and all I had to do was just kind of, like, send an email to one guy saying, Jason, I'd like you to take over the job now. And then when they needed more people in the warehouse, they were free to hire as they saw fit. And, it didn't really need me.
This has been one of the most incredible interviews. I don't know what to say. So you systematized your business that much. How many guys did you have working there? You said 80?
85, yeah. I mean,
were they in office or spread out? Like, what was the actual, like, setup of the house?
It was a giant warehouse. I mean, really, CDBaby was just a package ship warehouse business. So of those 85 people, that was about 50 in a warehouse, 25 in customer service, and there were really only about 5, maybe 8 jobs that you could call somewhat creative or executive desk jobs. So it was really just a kind of customer service and CD shipping factory.
And you managed the website?
Yeah, but I did all the programming myself. There was one other tech guy, Jason, who was really good at just kind of being there on a day-to-day level to fix little tech fires that came up. So I was kind of, I spent all my time kind of doing the...
So you had ultimate control since you ran the website.
Exactly, yeah. And in fact, honestly, here's a bit of a secret. When I heard that MP3 at the company meeting of everybody yelling, you know, fuck him, yeah, I logged in as root to the server and typed halt and shut down the site. And as I was writing... What I decided to do is just shut down the company. I was like, I'm not enjoying this anymore. I'm not doing it for money. Fuck you. And so what I was writing was the thank you for your business page. Like, I was going to just replace all of CDBaby.com with a page that just said, thanks for your business over the years. CDBaby's closed. We will be hiring a company and buy everybody's CDs. And I was just going to send an email to all employees going, you know what, guys, I'm not enjoying this. Go home. I'm shutting down the company. Goodbye. And so the site actually shut down for about 15 minutes as I was writing this goodbye page. And that's when I kind of, like, this was late at night. You know what, maybe I should sleep on this first.
Before you throw away $4 million a year that's coming in profit, right?
Exactly. So I typed startup again. I put the web server back up again. And that night I remembered that my original idea, when people started asking me way back in, like, 1999, are you going to sell a company? During the dot-com boom, you know, so everybody was flipping and selling things. And people would ask me if I was going to sell. I said, no way, I'm never selling. I said, but if I do, here's how I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it like Willy Wonka. I'm going to slip 5 golden tickets into 5 CDs and loudly announce to the world that I'm pulling Willy Wonka, that 5 CDs have 5 golden tickets in them, and whoever finds 5 golden tickets will be potential new owners of the company. Except because I don't own a chocolate river to push kid into, instead what I do is once the 5 golden tickets have been found, I'm going to hold a big musicians meeting in Woodstock, New York, where I started the company, and make a free-for-all. So any musicians who were my clients could come to this meeting, and then the 5 people who found 5 golden tickets, as long as they were interested, would get up there in front of everybody and each give their pitch for what they will do if they were owner of the company. And then the musicians would get to vote on who they want to be the new owner of the company. And then whoever they voted to, I would sign the company over to that person. Kind of like giving, you know, Charlie the key with a glass of water. And that person would be the new owner of CDBaby on the one condition that they were not allowed to sell. Like, at a certain point, they wanted out, it would revert back to me. So they couldn't just make a bunch of promises and then, you know, sell it to Amazon or something. So that was my, so that's why I decided to do that. And I was quite serious about it. I mean, I was really like, I was going to look at where I could get them.
That would have been an amazing news story. You would have, like, make totally. This company grow like by 1,000 times overnight.
Exactly. I mean, think about how musicians would be so thankful that would have sold billions of their CDs while people were searching for the golden ticket. And people would have just come in and placed these $10,000 orders just to find a golden ticket. So that was, I was quite serious about that plan for about a week and making real concrete arrangements to make it happen. And then somewhere along there, like the voice of, well, I call it the rabbi in my head. I'm not Jewish, but all my friends are. And I have this kind of imaginary stereotypical image of like the rabbi who's kind of like the voice of objective wisdom, you know, looking at my scenario from the outside going, like, so what, you're just going to walk away from this whole thing? So, you know, you could sell the company for $20 million, but you don't want to because why?
Right.
And so it's kind of the voice of the little rabbi in my head made me think, yeah, you know, it's kind of really walk a golden ticket idea. It's funny, it's fun, and it excites me, but, you know, there might come a time when I'm 50 years old having to get a job at Starbucks, as you say, because I walked away instead of selling. And I think I might regret that when I'm older. So that's when I decided, it's a nice story. I guess I'll fill it on my blog someday, but in the end, I just old.
Yeah,
you're right. So this is all started by asking about me living kind of like you're living, living in gorgeous islands in the Caribbean somewhere. I've been living the laptop life for a few years. I really like it. I like that idea of living for a few years each in a bunch of different countries and challenging myself to, for my next company, to have no office and have no employees and just have it set from day one so that everybody is working as freelance people from home and just set the system that way from day one. Might be a failure, but I might learn a lot of good stuff along the way. So, worth a try.
No, it's more than worth a try. Well, I can certainly talk to you about it. Well, we didn't end up talking about how you built your other company, but I think this has actually been a far more interesting conversation, and so thank you.
Thanks. Well, yeah, the new company didn't exist yet, so I'm still just really just doing the quiet back-end programming of the basic administrative interface, you know, the boring stuff, you know, create an account, forgot your password, all that kind of stuff. So I'm still doing the programming. It doesn't exist yet, but it's just a plan. It's just a plan as of now, but, you know, maybe we'll talk in a couple of years and I'll have a cool story to tell.
Yeah. Is there anything that you want to talk about which you haven't covered?
Nope.
Cool. Derek, that's for your time.
Okay, thanks a lot.